Let's get ready to Syntax.
You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Talensky and Wes Boss.
This is the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today, we've got a show for you on browser APIs. I would probably call these vanilla JavaScript or web APIs. Things that you can do in the browser that are neat and what you would use them for. Or maybe we should call it nifty. That's a word we use. 10 nifty browser APIs that we're going to go through today. We are sponsored by three awesome companies today. Prismic, the headless CMS with the GraphQL and REST API. LogRocket, JavaScript Session Replay, and FreshBooks Cloud Accounting. We'll talk about all of those awesome companies partway through the episode. My name is Wes Boss. I'm a developer from Canada. And with me, as always, is Mr. Scott Talensky. How are you doing today, Scott?
Oh, I'm doing good. feeling fine here, man. We got a dishwasher. And let me tell you, I've never loved a dishwasher more.
I have
been hand washing all my dishes for both the kids. And it takes me like an hour and a half every single night. And I've been doing now for what like feels like eight months, like basically since we moved into this house. And the dishwasher has finally arrived. And man, it feels good. It feels good that I am like able to actually put the kids down to bed with Courtney instead of doing the dishes. So yeah, I'm in a good mood because
that's good.
Yeah.
That dishwasher you bought is unreal. This morning I was unloading our dishwasher and we hadn't turned the lights on. It was still kind of dark. And yours has lights inside the freaking dishwasher.
Looks like a spaceship when you open
that's
it.
That's amazing.
You know, the coolest thing about the dishwasher to me, which sounds stupid, is just how easily the drawers slide on it. Dishwasher drawers, those things be annoying, right? They get hooked up. They get these drawers are just like almost too smooth. It's like shocking. So, yeah, I'm a fan of the dishwasher. Let's just say that. So, yeah, I've been having a good week here. It's been a good week for me.
Dishwasher talk. Somebody tweeted that they like our podcast because we don't talk about olive oil for the first 10 minutes. And I was like, hold on. That's actually something we'll probably do.
feels like something we might actually do.
I'm pretty sure we've probably done that.
I've been doing a lot of like outdoor landscaping work this weekend and stuff. Feeling that I cut a giant tree down by myself. And I did so for a tree that was next to a power line. It was growing up into the power line and it was already kind of leaning. And it was leaning so much that I was thinking like, man, it would be really great if the wind would just do the rest of this job, you know, and really knock this thing down. And then we had a super windy day and it didn't come down, but it just started leaning even more. I was like, you know what? I'm going to take care of this and I'm going to do it, I guess, as developer-y as you can, where you're just kind of like taking it one step at a time. I have, you know, where I'd like it to end up, where I'd like it to go. And I cut the wedges like you see on YouTube, you cut the wedge and then the wedge. And would you know, a giant 20-foot some or 15-foot tall tree thing landed exactly where I wanted it.
Wow.
Cut it up. I'm really impressed with myself. So
that's good. I watch a lot of like tree disaster where it falls on the house or something like that.
Right.
So did you get any hate? I once fell a tree on Instagram and man, did I get a lot of hate from people. We literally have thousands of trees on our property and I got skinned alive for taking down a perfectly fine tree that was going to rot.
Oh yeah. Well, no, I didn't get any hate, but if to preemptively get it inside, this thing was grown into the power lines. Whoever planted it should never have planted it there. It was already had a major lean. It was going to come down on its own, even though it was alive. Like this thing was a disaster waiting to happen. The last thing I wanted it to do was to fall on our patio furniture when I wasn't out there, or to fall on a kid or the dog or something. So yeah. I took matters into my own hand and I took this thing down. We also have a literal forest at our house. So one of these trees is not going to make a difference here.
Oh, man. All right, let's get into it. We got 10 for you here. Number one is something that's probably a lot of you have used is Get User Media. Get User Media is a browser API that allows you to access user media. Two most common of those are going to be your user's webcam as well as your user's microphone. And there are a whole bunch of other APIs that surround Get User Media. that allow you to access multiple cameras at once. If you go to hair.westboss.com, I wrote a quick little app that gets every single webcam that's available on your computer and will display it. And I'm not lying, I had 9 webcams. Don't ask me why I have 9 webcams, because I went searching through the box of cords. But I had 9 webcams rolling all at once, and you can do it and get the name of the webcam. If you're doing it on mobile, you can get whether it is a front or a back camera, or I forget the words that they use to describe it. I even ran it on my car's head unit, and it detected the dash cam as a webcam. Yeah, I was very happy about that. It crashed after a while, and I didn't dig into why, but kind of interesting.
Is your dash cam like integrated into the car?
No, the dash cam is its own thing, but it has a USB interface to power it and also to view. So the head unit that I bought has like an application for reviewing the dash cam footage. So it's smart enough to talk to the USB dash cam. And I'm assuming it's just the same stuff as a webcam.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much you can do with Get User Media overall. And I you know, even just like fun stuff. And I do feel like maybe some like fun projects are missing from people's side projects nowadays, where you're just like, I'm going to take my webcam feed. I'm going to pipe it into a canvas. I'm going to apply some effects to it. I'm going to goof around with the pixels. Mm-hmm. There's so much to be done there. That's not just like building a Zoom competitor or something where you're utilizing the webcam for practical reasons.
Totally. If you go to I'll shamelessly plug my JavaScript30.com course, where we build lots of fun stuff with the webcam, and we apply. It's kind of fun because you can take the feed from a webcam. It's called source object. You dump that into a video element. And then once it's in a video element, it's essentially just a PNG or a JPEG. And you can then dump that into a canvas element. And then from there, sky's the limit, right?
Yeah, you have access to every pixel.
Every pixel.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of potentials there. All right, the next one here is going to be an API that is newer, and it's one of my. I just did a course as well. I don't, you know, didn't want this to be a plug-isode, but
let's do it.
I'll plug-isode. My course-isode is a latest course I've done is about browser API specifically, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to do this episode. My brain's so in this space. And one of the APIs that we did in our course on Level Up Tutorials was for the file system API. And the file system API is, you might be thinking, well, I can upload things already to the web. Why do I need the file system API? Well, the file system API gives you access to reading files, reading directories, writing to files. And in under 40 lines of code in our course, we built an SVG editor, as in you click a button, you select your SVG file, it populates a text area with the SVG code, you can modify it, then you click the save button in browser, and it saves the file to your local file system. It doesn't download a new one, which is what many of these currently things, the previous, you know, crop of file editors or those types of things would do in that situation, right? It doesn't download a zip or anything like that. It straight up saves the file on your file system. And even on top of that, we build like a little directory browser in no lines, like 50 lines of code, where you can click through directories, go home, open up a file, check out what the file is. And all of this works really stinking well. What happens is basically you have a file picker. So you have a function that's show file picker. That file picker opens up the native file picker. You can either select a file or a directory based on, you can also get a directory picker as well. You get access to what's called the handle and or an array of handles. The handle will either be a type of file or a type of directory. Then you can choose to go into that directory. Now you have that directory handle. You can then see all of the file handles inside of that directory handle. And at any given point, you can select a file, modify it. And as long as you have that file handle, which is included in any of the things you're grabbing, you can then save that file. And the only thing that's going to pop up is a little permissions thing on the browser to say, hey, this thing's trying to write to your file system. Do you want it to do that? You just say yes. So it's really way easier than you might expect. I mean, I'm talking like under 40 lines of vanilla JS to get a basic file editor going.
Yeah.
The biggest issue with the file system API is compatibility. But if you're building if you wanted to like take your hand at trying to build a fun project, like a file explorer using, what's the one?
Electron.
Electron. Yeah. I could think of Express and Tori, and I'm like, it's not Express. if you wanted to build an Electron app, then you know you're shipping Chrome, because this thing is really only supported in Chromium based browsers. And it has some support in Safari. There's, mostly has support in Safari. Some of the things are a little bit tougher in Safari. There's a little bit more red there than what you might expect. In fact, I don't think there's right support at all in Safari. But if you're using Chrome in a Chromium-based anything, then you can utilize this to do some really, really fancy stuff. No Firefox, no Internet Explorer, obviously. Some small Safari support. But yeah, Chrome, yeah, that's where it's at.
That's kind of cool. And that's not as big of a deal, I don't think, as you might think it is, because a lot of the use case for file system APIs is if you're working in, like we said, an Electron application. And in that case, it's literally only running in a Chrome environment. It says on MDN, it says the interface will not grant you access to the user's file system. Instead, you have a virtual drive within the browser sandbox. If you want to gain access to the user's file system and need to invoke the user, example, by installing a Chrome extension, the relevant Chrome API can be found here. So it looks like you can use it in Firefox, but it is read-only, and it is in like a sandbox. So I'm not sure how you would eventually get that out of Firefox. And it's a tricky thing, because as soon as you cross that bridge from being in a sandbox of the browser into your user's computer, then you open up a world of potential issues and security issues where you can access your user's files, right? There's a reason why websites have been pretty safe. And there's a reason, that's also one of the reasons why the iPhone never wanted to do Flash, because that's a third-party thing that is running locally on your device. It's not running in the browser. It's running on your computer, and it can access your whole computer's file system. And that's a possible security issue there too.
Yeah, what's that Windows file that it was like a common troll back in the day to say delete system 32 or whatever was on? Yeah, you could have a delete system 32. Good. Yeah.
Let's do one more for our ad break, and that's geolocation. This one's been around for a very long time. For some reason, I still think of this as a new browser API, as an HTML5 browser API, but literally it's probably been around for 12 years. And geolocation, it's navigator.geolocation. And you can get a couple things. You can watch the current position, and that will tell you when the user's location is updated. You can just get the location once. That's good for like if you have a map or something like that, and you just want to, instead of having to ask a user to type in their postal code, you can just automatically zone them in. Although, like, let's talk about that for a second. Isn't it annoying when you go to a website right away and the first thing it asks you is, can I have access to your location? It's like, no, no, for what? Nope. And then like later on, you're like, oh, because you want to find the closest store to me. Like, ask me that when I want to find that, right? Not because I'm going to say no and it's going to block it. And it's very hard to get regular users to unblock those geolocation things once they've blocked it, because it's kind of a weird UI in your browsers, especially on mobile.
Yeah, I was on a Home Depot website last night.
That's who I was thinking of, yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I was just on Home Depot last night, and I opened Home Depot and it's like, where are you? What are you doing right now? Who are you with? And I'm just like, I'm not willing to divulge that, Home Depot. And it's so weird how it makes you feel a little uncomfortable when it prompts you. Yeah, have it prompt you if you want to do like select your store, then let it prompt you. But don't prompt me when I just opened the website. That's
weird. And the other thing about that is, I'm visiting HomeDepot.com, and that's for the American, but it tells that I'm the closest Home Depot to me is in Niagara Falls, which is true. It's right across the border, but I haven't yet given it access to my location. So like you can get pretty close with server side stuff and then get a little more closer when you ask for access. So yeah, come on, Home Depot.
Come on, data backend CMSs. Why aren't you so cool like one of our sponsors today, Prismic?
Yes, Prismic is a headless CMS that is going to make your websites awesome. So they say generate growth by rapidly creating strategic on-brand pages, assemble them with reusable website selections, aka slices. So you guys know what a headless CMS is. You know what a GraphQL API is. What Prismic really doubles down on is this concept of slices, which I like to think of mapping your data pieces to components. So instead of creating a page on inside of Prismic, what you can do is you can create you can obviously create people and users and food. You can create all your different data types. And then with those, you can assemble them together. Be like, okay, let me have a user and a food. And then that could be a slice. And then you can make a slice in Prismic. You can make your component in whatever end framework you're using, React or Svelte or Vue or Next or Nuxt or whatever it is. And it's really cool because then you can click together all of those slices into a page via the Prismic UI. They give you a whole, you just log in, immediately you have a UI. You don't have to create any of that stuff yourself. And that's awesome for growth and marketing and things like that, because you can put together 40 different pages by just taking your existing data and snapping it together. So check it out. It's really good, both from like the UI, but also from like a developer point of view. I've built a couple sites in it myself. Prismic.io/syntax. Thank you, Prismic, for sponsoring.
Next one that we're going to be talking about is the permissions API. Wes, have you really taken a gander at the permissions API at all?
Oh, I'm trying to remember. Oh, yeah. This is having access to things like notifications and the clipboard and whatnot, being able to figure out if you are allowed to do something before you go forward with it. Is that what it's for?
Yeah, it is for that. But, you know, it's funny because the permissions API is only supported by a couple of notable APIs, the clipboard API, the notifications, the push API, and WebMIDI, which is WebMIDI's kind of its own troubled thing. And what's interesting about the permissions API is that the permissions API has really bad support. So you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to use the permissions API to check to see if I have permission to do this thing. But I also have to check to see if the permissions API even works at all in the current browser, or even then there's like ways that it's like implemented differently. So for instance, you could use the permissions API to prompt the user ahead of time to get the permission of the thing. Because typically what happens, like let's go to say you want to access geolocation. You access the geolocation, then the prompt comes and says, would you like to give this website, you know, the location of your firstborn child? And you say yes. But in this permissions API, the idea would be here that you could control what user permissions exist or even check to see their status of directly from JavaScript in the browser. And let me tell you, this is one of those APIs that I included it in here to let you know that it exists, but that you should be very cautious when using it because the support is all over the place. And I found this to be one of the more frustrating like carrot dangles where it's just like, ooh, I really want that carrot, but I can't have it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I find this very frustrating on the web because if somebody says no to a permission, you have no API in most cases. In the clipboard notifications pushing WebMIDI, you do. But in the rest of them, you have no recourse to fix that. And that can be frustrating for your user. No, I don't want to give you access to my webcam. And then I go, oh, you needed my webcam because I need to take a photo of my driver's license or whatever, you know? And then trying to tell the user how to undo that is very frustrating, especially on mobile. So like what a lot of apps do is they will first pop up do you want to give us access to your webcam? And then they'll have like their own UI that says yes or no. And if you say yes, then it'll actually pop up the users because you only have one. Same with on the iPhone, you really only have one shot to ask a user for access to that. And then I feel like I'm pretty technical. And sometimes I'm just like, oh, freaking, how do I, how do I change the
puzzle
this
piece
setting?
Or the,
it's somewhere in the cog icon. Scroll through a list of 40 apps. And like, that's frustrating that you should be able to undo that programmatically. It's, I don't know, because that's also frustrating because then it could be misused, right? Like someone could just be constantly popping it up. Like you'd have to like, it's sort of like ad blocking and pop-ups. Like pop-ups have they're a good use case, but they are also can be abused. So they had to like tie pop-ups to real clicks, you know, and remember that was a big problem. You had pop-up blockers.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, I watch some pirated sports content occasionally on some websites that pop-ups are just like constantly flying in your face, especially on iOS. Like so here's a good instance. They black out all the Colorado Avalanche games in Denver if you don't have Comcast. And it's like, to watch my local hockey team, I have to go to a shady website. I have to open it and then get 8,000 pop-ups blasted in my face and then close them all, or it opens new tabs on the iPad. And it's just like, yeah, man, pop-ups are still an issue for me.
Oh, man, that's crazy. Permissions API. That's one of those ones. Like, do you think it's going to get better? Like, what is this still being worked on? Will eventually the permissions API support all of the ones that we're talking about today?
I hope so. And you know what is at least exciting is that Chrome, of course, our champion Chrome. For anybody who wants to say, you know, Chrome taking over the web, whatever, just look at the support for stuff like this. They have nothing but green check marks for which APIs are supported here. And to me, this seems like a no-brainer for browsers to get on, like permission access to query permissions or just to see their status. That feels like something you should have, but the red is Firefox and Safari and iOS, Safari, obviously, WebView for Android. So I don't know. There's support for Chrome and Android, and occasional support in Firefox. It's just a bummer that this kind of same pattern emerges all the time, but I would hope so. It does seem like some of them still have little experimental flasks next to the name, and some of them have little trash cans and exclamation points. But in my experience, like, the permissions API was the one that I was like, man, it would be really great if I could use it. But you cannot. So, yeah.
Next one we have here, I'm going to let you take this one because I know this is your baby. And this is not something I've used directly. I've used stuff that uses the web animation API, but not something I've used directly. And I'm just looking at, I love some of my favorite times are just looking through docs on MDN being like, wow, this is a whole different world. So web animations API, tell me about it.
Yeah, the web animations API is basically a way to construct animations with JavaScript and without having to really dive into CSS animations or transitions. Now, the thing that's interesting about the web animations API is basically you create the animation and then you get access to essentially play, pause, reverse, update, playback rate, those types of things, as if it was like a movie. So unlike like CSS transitions where you're giving a transition, or CSS animations where you're just attaching an animation to it, simply creating the animation like doesn't do anything. You have to create the animation and then tell it to go. So you'd want to do that on some sort of we did it in our Gatsby course, like on PageRoute. We had an animation fire. But yeah, you would have to have some kind of event that triggers this animation, or it's just straight up JavaScript, so you could have it call after you're defining it. And the web animations API is kind of known as being good because you don't have to use very simple terms here. It's good because you don't have to have a library for it, but it's bad in terms of just like with many of these other things like web components and whatever, it's not as good as what the tools are in the various browser frameworks. Like Framer Motion, way better. And Svelte Animations, way better. But actually in comes a library from the creator of Framer Motion. It's called Motion One. And I would actually recommend checking this out in addition to the Web Animations API. Because what this does is it's basically like He's just basically saying, yeah, the API is kind of cumbersome for creating animations with the Web Animations API. And what if we just made it nice? And since it's using browser APIs, what you end up having is a very small library compared to, you know, a Frame or Motion type of deal. And it works in everything. And
Frame or Motion just uses JavaScript to apply CSS properties?
Yeah. And interpolate spring values and things like that.
Okay. Yeah. Not just, but yeah, obviously. Okay.
Yeah. Because you have to, and flip animations, those types of deals as well. So this is going to maybe do less than what Frame or Motion would do, but it's going to work with everything. And the library size is going to be way smaller. And it's also a very cute website. So Wes, you might like this deep blue and yellow and black.
I'm into that.
Yep.
Wow. I should say, I don't necessarily think like the web animations API being frustrating to use is necessarily a bad thing, because right, there's a lot of stuff in the browser that is just a primitive and it's meant to be built on top of. And then there's other stuff that's like, you just use it straight up, like fetch. Fetch, you can build stuff on top of Fetch, but you can also just use it straight up, and it's a very ergonomic to just use directly. Whereas like maybe something like the Web Animations API or some of these other audio APIs that we've worked on, they can be very frustrating to work on. But somebody has made a very nice kind of layer on top of it.
Yeah, totally.
Next one we have here is the Resize Observer API. This is one of my favorites. I've been talking about this one in Converse Talks for a while. I use it on my own website. Basically, when you want to know when an element on the page changes, its width or height, or I believe just width or height, or no, where also where it is on the API, or sorry, where it is on the browser, you can watch those with Resize Observer. You can observe them with Resize Observer. This is really handy because previously you would only be able to listen for the window to be resized. And if, for example, like the example I always gave in my conference talk is if you have a video player on the left and you have a list of videos on the right, and the list of videos you can make smaller or larger depending on your personal preference, then when you make the list of videos wider, then the video itself gets smaller. And if you need to trigger a bunch of JavaScript, kind of like media queries, but for individual elements, right? We talked about, what's the container queries?
Yeah.
It's kind of like container queries, but in JavaScript, where you can programmatically wait for something to change. And it can be used for all kinds of stuff. If you want to know, is an element currently on the screen or not? If you want to do something like scroll in or play a video once somebody has scrolled into view, or pause a video when somebody scrolled away from it, that can be a very helpful API.
Yeah, we use it. Actually, I made a Svelte heads out there. I made a Svelte action for container queries that just assigns classes based on the browser width. But let me tell you, I mean, this is like no lines of code. We have a new Resize Observer. And then inside of the Resize Observer, we're just looking at the current node. We're getting its bounding client rect dot width. So we have its width, and then we're able to check its width and then change classes based on the dimensions that you've provided in an array. And it was really easy. I mean, the whole thing is less than 20 lines of code. And I mean, that goes to show you that Resize Observer is a pretty viable method for doing this kind of thing. It can be, you don't want to go overboard with it, because it can be a bit hefty, I think, performance-wise, but we use it on every single one of our cards in a giant grid of cards and don't notice a huge issue with that. So,
yeah, I've never ran into issues with Resize Observer, and I think that's because the alternative was checking every 300 milliseconds, checking if it changed. And in this case, the browser knows when elements are on the page or off the page, and the browser knows when elements are bigger or smaller because it's literally painting them to the browser. So who better to tell you when something has changed than the device that is painting the rectangles to the browser?
If you're playing with any of these APIs, you might be hitting some browser errors, and a good solution for staying on top of that type of thing, maybe perhaps you've tried to use the permissions API and it's saying, hey, this don't work, and it broke your thing. Well, you might want to check out a service like LogRocket, because LogRocket is going to give you a video, a scrubbable video replay of what exactly happened that broke your site, how it happened, the error logs and all that. So let's say you try to access the permissions API. It's not supported in your browser. Well, it's going to you're going to be able to see exactly what the user saw when you tried to maybe request their permissions or check their permissions. And then there's an error or something didn't work. You're going to be able to see exactly what that user experienced. And not only that, but LogRocket has added a bunch of new features and tools around just making your users have a better time on the applications that you're writing, the websites that you're creating, because we can now not only stop guessing why bugs happen with scrubbable video replays, but we also get to see how customers are engaged with the site. So they have new convert, engage, and retain features as well with heat maps and data-driven design decisions. So check it out at logrocket.com/syntax sign up and you'll get 14 days for free. Thank you, LogRocket, for sponsoring. All right, next one here is the Clipboard API. The Clipboard API is kind of what it sounds like. You have copy, you got paste. You can copy and paste images and stuff like that. There's a little bit more to it in terms of like what's supported in what browser. But if you're talking basic reading, like copying text is pretty much supported everywhere. And the caveat is that no Internet Explorer, who cares, right? But if you want to just straight up copy and paste or copy, not copy and paste, but copy text, it's as easy as really just saying navigator.clipboard.read text. And then you just pass in some text there and it returns a promise. That's it. And it's really amazing. That's so great. In fact, I've been using this a lot. I made a video that you don't need a browser dependency for this, but not only can you read text, you can also write text as well. And when you go to write text, let's say you have an event, you have a paste button. The paste API for this does require more permissions than the copy one, because copy just copies to your clipboard, right? Paste is kind of a little bit more invasive if you're thinking about it, right? Like what if you had your bank details in your your clipboard and then the website's looking at your paste? So they can't just look at whatever's in your clipboard without you accepting it. So with write text, when you go to use it, it's going to fire off a permission to say, hey, it's trying to access your clipboard. You just say yes, and then it goes through. And you can actually do media and stuff with this too, which is less supported. But if you're trying to get into just basic copying text, man, navigator.clipboard.readtext couldn't be any easier.
Man, I put it into our coupon dashboard so you can copy a coupon.
Yeah, me too.
And it's great because like, you can programmatically copy not just the text that's in there, but it says you can use the coupon for 20% off, $10 off, you know? And it was like, it didn't even have to make a function for it. Just inside an on-click handler. There's no dependencies, nothing for it. Not even a function. One thing I want to know is like, can you tell if there is something in someone's clipboard? Because like, I love that on an iPhone app where you copy like a one-time password and you go back and it says paste from clipboard. I'm like, yes, that's exactly what I was going to do. I don't want to have to hold it for 1.2 seconds and wait for the little bubble to pop up. Just do it for me.
Yeah, you could. You just read text. I think I've several times in this past minute swapped the word read with write. So if I did that and you're confused by what I was saying, woof, what's going on? Yeah. Okay. Well, either way, yes, it can absolutely read your text with permissions.
Oh, read text. You're right.
Yeah. And it can, but it will prompt you first. So it will come up with a little browser prompt to say, hey, this thing's trying to read what's in your clipboard. And then after it reads that, then it can check to see if it is a specific type of thing.
Yeah,
whatever.
Matches six characters, they're all
Does
numbers.
Does this look like a bank account? Could I, copy this? Yeah.
Beautiful. Next one we have here is the Web Storage API. This includes both session storage and local storage. Local storage is probably the most commonly used one. It's a great key value store. You can only store text. So if you want to be able to store like objects or numbers or anything like that, it's best to store them as JSON. So that when you pull them out again, they will maintain their structure and their types and whatever. But there's also session storage. What's the difference between local and session storage, Scott?
Session storage goes away is really what it comes down to. So when your session is over, then your session storage is gone, where local storage is going to stay there. So basically, session meaning when the browser or the tab has closed. So if you store something in the session, and the API, the interface is the same way as storing in local storage, it's just the word session storage instead. But if you store something in session storage, then close the tab, that thing is gone. So I personally don't use session storage for anything. So I'd be really interested in, I wonder what like the use case is there for that.
Yeah, I think like what would be very useful is like people at the library are using the same computer over and over again. Mm. Like you shouldn't be sticking stuff, even cookies, you shouldn't be sticking stuff in there that is possible that somebody later is going to be using that possible login, right? And I think most libraries have like a whole wipe sequence that will do wipe it, but not all of them, right? So that's a good use case.
Yeah, they got a wipe sequence. Yeah.
I think we talked about this previously. Oh, Scott.
My kids are learning the wipe sequence right now. That's
a good one. I think we talked about this in the past. Is session storage shared amongst tabs? Because that's another, although like I can't imagine... Like, what's a good use case for that where you have two different tabs open and you are different? I hate that when it's like PayPal used to be this way. You open something in a new tab, it's like, log in? Like, no.
Oh, God.
No. I want to view this transaction as a secondary tab. It's no longer that way anymore. But
famous.
Yeah. Where are they now? No, they fixed that, obviously. But that was a frustrating thing. There's still websites like that where it's like, you cannot open this in a new tab. Why not? So web storage, kind of an interesting one. I use it quite a bit in my courses just as a way to store data locally. It's kind of like a little database and you can just stick stuff in there and maintain, or even if you just need to temporarily put something, you're filling out a form and somebody refreshes that page, you could store the data in local storage and stick it back in the form.
So before we get into the last two, let's talk about one of our sponsors, which is FreshBooks. Now, FreshBooks, cloud accounting. Wes, do you want to talk a little bit about cloud accounting with FreshBooks?
I do. FreshBooks is the best way to run your business's accounting. You've got invoices you need to track. You've got expenses. You've got taxes that need to be remitted. You've got projects that you are billing to different clients. You're trying to track time. They can track kilometers now if you're driving for it. All kinds of awesome stuff. One thing I've been using recently is importing all of my expenses directly from the credit card, and then just matching those up with actual receipts when I need to. And that's great because that makes sure that, I totally forgot about the DigitalOcean this month. You know, you're not going to miss any of that stuff. And that's key when you're trying to lower your taxable income. So FreshBooks really helps me with that. Check it out. FreshBooks.com/syntax, 30-day free trial, no credit card required. Thank you, FreshBooks, for sponsoring.
Sick. All right, let's get into the last two that we wanted to cover in this episode. First of being speech synthesis, as in text to speech. And this is another one, you know, it's actually a common theme for me in these browser APIs. They're all way easier, with the exception of a couple of them, than you might expect.
Yeah.
So you think, you know, it was really easy to make the Mac talk a long time ago. You know, that was always a fun thing. You pop up and text it and you make the Mac say, hello, better, happier, you know, Radiohead thing or whatever.
Yeah.
But you can do this in the browser so easily. And it definitely is one of those ones that you can get some use case out of. Me personally, I built a dance app, and I wanted the dance app to shout different dance moves at me while I was dancing, so that I like didn't know what was coming up. It was sort of like randomized, right? So I get a big old array of all my dance moves, and then every like 20 seconds, it will shout at me like a new thing to do. So that way I can get used to doing things in different orders and patterns. And it was so easy to just hook up and to get this going in absolutely no time. And you could do even more than just, hey, here's a text, click play and have this speech. You can change the pitch. You can change the voice. You can change the speed. you can do anything you want. And in my course, what we do is we just have like a text input box you can type in, you click play, you can tweak it that way. And it, you'll see very quickly just how simple it is to get text to speech. But it, honestly, I was one of those ones I was shocked as like, it feels just too easy to do it. You know, it feels too easy.
Yeah. I use them in my JavaScript 30 course, and I recently put out a tweet with speech synthesis in it, and it literally fits into a tweet to be able to speak something to the user. It's unreal how quick it is. There's different voices that you can get. The Mac supports way more voices. So a lot of these APIs are just reaching and using system APIs. So on Windows, there's, I don't know, whatever Microsoft Bob or whatever the voice is on that. And then there's like 15, there's like 15 voices on there. And you can also change the pitch and tone of the actual voice. So you can make it sound like a chipmunk. And I'm just going to keep plugging my own course, JavaScript 30. It's free. I'm not making money off this thing, but we make this thing called the Voicinator 5000, where you can type in what you want. You can change the rate, so how fast it goes and the pitch. It's really, really fun. I love those ones. And that's also a really good one. If you're new to coding, that's one you should try, because like, how empowering is that in 6 lines of code? You all of a sudden have something speaking back to you.
Yeah, for real. It is fun. It's also just straight up fun. I'm glad you gave yours a fun name, because that's part of what makes it nice.
Exactly. It's a very well supported API. I'm just looking at the speech synthesis is not supported in Opera Android, WebView Android, and Internet Explorer. So like nowhere where you'd probably want to use it. Everywhere else, it is extremely well supported, which is really good. The next one we have here is speech recognition. And this is the opposite. So it's text to speech, not speech to text. And this one will take your microphone feed.
Wait, it's speech to text, not text to speech.
Yes. What did I say?
I think the opposite of that, but I also might have just heard the opposite.
Okay. It's whatever you're saying to text. So it will recognize what you are saying. And it's really good because you can pass it a set of grammars, what language you're speaking, whether you want it continuous. So as you are speaking, it will stream results in. So if you think about Siri or Google Home or Alexa, if you are talking to it, you see it's changing what you think you're saying as you're talking. And you can stream in those results, and then it will fire off an end event once it thinks you're done talking. And then it'll also give you a bunch of alternatives. And there's like a number for how confident it thinks it is. I forget what it is. It'll tell you how confident it is in the words that you're saying. And I made a game that it was called the Web Speech Colors game, where I put every color in CSS, blue, green, red, pale goldenrod, yellow is actually a CSS color. And you have to try to say all of them as fast as you possibly can. And as you say them, it will bam, 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 like knock them off. And it's like a little game where you can speak to it, which is pretty fun. So
it's like those
that's
Brain
a really
Academy
fun
games.
One. Yeah, it doesn't work in Firefox, doesn't work in Opera, which is surprising because it works super well in Chrome, Edge, Safari, pretty much across the board, except for grammars. What is grammars? Grammars are a property of speech recognition interface. It returns a set of collection objects that represent the grammars that will be understood by the current speech recognition. Hmm. So I guess you just give it a list of words. And in the example of things that they're doing, they're passing it goldenrod. They're passing colors. So I wonder if they took my example when they're writing the docs for this. That's awesome.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Cool. Maybe not. Who knows? I'm not going to take credit for that one, but maybe. Because some of them were hard to say. If you want to say magenta or khaki or fuchsia, ghost white, that's a cool one. Maybe it doesn't recognize it.
You saying fuchsia was very fun here.
I tripped on it because Paul Irish had a talk like a long time ago, and he used to always say fuchsia.
Gotta love Paul Irish, yeah.
Fuchsia. Cool. We should have him on the show. He's got some stories to tell, I bet.
That'd be awesome. If we want to talk old web stuff, like,
yeah,
he seems maybe like we just need to do
like a Sunday afternoon podcast of talking with the oldies.
Talking with the oldies. Yes. Cool. I'm sure they would love that. If we called it talking with the oldies.
I'm sure people would appreciate that. These are all the APIs we're here to cover. I would say if you want to have a fun weekend or learn a thing or two, try to build at least a little example in every single one of these APIs because your eyes will be opened. And it's also a nice like little refresh from doing like stuff from like fetch data from an API, loop over it, display it in whatever framework you're using. Because this stuff is just HTML file. Most of them need a local server to work because the permissions are tied to a origin, like a .com or a localhost. And also, we should say most of these will not work on HTTP.
Correct.
So if
yes.
you ever deploy any of these to a website, you must have a SSL certificate, but they will work on localhost because localhost is
considered secure. And SSL certificates are just increasingly common now and increasingly easy to use. So
it's almost hard to not have an SSL certificate these days. So
it is. Yeah. That's very accurate. Cool. Well, that should do it for our browser APIs. There's just an endless amount more. If you want more information on browser APIs, take Wes's JavaScript 30 course, take my Exploring Browser APIs course, real world practical examples for all of that good stuff. So now's the part of the show we're going to get into sick picks.
Sick.
Sick picks. I have a sick pick, Wes.
Yeah.
That is, it's a little box here that I got, and it's $15. And let me show you here. I don't know about you, but I have a ton of old either VHS or mini DV or DV tapes, stuff that's never going to get translated elsewhere. And this little $15 box is RCA on one end for the input, and the output is HDMI. And let me tell you, what I did with this thing, I did my mini DV camera RCA to this box, and then I did HDMI to my Elgato Cam Link, the capture card that we have. And I've been converting all my DV tapes, which is just so wonderful. And if I have VHS tapes, which I do, and an old VHS player, which I do, that I want to get digitized, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to connect them to this thing and then record it into QuickTime. It's been a breeze. It was $15. If you're like me and you have this kind of stuff and you either want to watch them or whatever, you know, the only other way for me to do this was via FireWire 400. You would not believe how difficult it is to get FireWire 400 into a modern MacBook Pro. It is just about impossible. So really saved my bacon. And if you're out there like me with a bunch of old media, $15, easy buy.
My dad recently moved my grandma out of her house, and he got a box of old VHSs from like family movies, and he's doing that right now. I think he bought the same one, and I had I had to find him a VCR at a thrift store and put it in. But it's interesting. I went down the other route, which is our van. I didn't realize our van had HDMI in. So I just thought our van had like, what is it? RCA, the three.
Yeah.
Are they or composite? Whatever. RCA. Yeah. And I got one of those HDMI to RCA. And then I tried converting like an iPad from Lightning to HDMI to RCA. And none of the apps worked because of copy protection. Because they're like, no, you're trying to stream this and like capture the output on an analog device, right? And they said, no, you're not allowed to do that. So, but then I realized we had HDMI. And a lot of the Lightning to HDMI adapters didn't work. They still said, no, you can't do that. You can't output HDMI, but the official Apple one did work. So I was pretty happy about that.
It's such a SHIT show.
I know. It's HDCP is what it was called. High bandwidth digital content protection. And Netflix and Disney Plus would not work unless I bought the official Apple one. So there's some special sauce going on inside of that.
There's some sauce in there.
Some sauce. I talked to a bunch of people on Twitter about it as well. And they were like, I have converted a bunch. There's like there's always people on Twitter that have like worked in different industries, and like some people that worked on retrofitting old theaters to work with HDMI. And like these theaters have $50,000 projectors. They're not going to upgrade that, but they need HDMI input. Mm. And they said, we would just buy like a dozen off of Amazon, and random ones would work and random ones wouldn't work. And we don't know why, but like I would buy three of the same ones. And once you found one that worked, you return the rest. It's yeah. crazy.
As a projectionist, as a former projectionist, Wes, I actually went to a projection conference and all that stuff. I got to, dig into all that. Yeah. They like made me blog about it when I went there too. My boss was like, can we get some blog posts? I'm like, nobody's going to read this blog. This blog doesn't even like, we made a blog for a low level employee to go to a projector conference, and like, kind of, I'm not even a writer. Like, I don't know why they made me do a blog about it, but I had to do a blog about it. Either way, we had those things, situations where like we had like a giant rack of all sorts of inputs and outputs that would go to the projector. And there would be situations where like, yeah, if you have this one DVD and it doesn't work in this player, just try it in the next one. And if it doesn't work in that player, try it in the next one. And like, I mean, there were so many weird things like that where you just had weird kind of tech mysteries where it would work or not work.
So bizarre. I'm going to sick pick slim LED pot lights. I have put these things in very many of places. So what these are these tiny, thin, like they're like less than, like probably about less than half an inch thick. And you can get them in the common one is 4 inch. You can get them in 6 and 8 inch as well. And what's so cool about them is that you just have to get like a 4 inch hole saw, whoop, whoop, drill a hole in your ceiling, and then run wire from, likely you already have a ceiling light. I'll give an example. In my office at the cottage, I put like a fan light combo in there. And it's just not bright enough. It's just like one light was not enough in there. So what I'm doing is I drilled two more holes and got two of these. They're super bright LED lights. And then you just run wire from the main light and tap it off. And you don't need to put junction boxes in the ceiling because it comes with a junction box. So you put the wire in this box, it comes with these little clips. You just push it in. And then you do have to buy one like little strain relief thing at the actual hardware store. And then you just throw that in the ceiling, and that counts as the junction box. Hmm. And they're like $8 a light. You can get them in all kinds of different colors. I got one on my desk right here that I'm testing because I'm not sure what color I want for my new office. I'm not sure if I want like a super white, bright one, or if I want like a bit of a warmer feel. But I just put them in so many different places. They're super cheap, super easy to get. They just work so well. I think if you have any space that you want to modernize and you already have a ceiling light, any monkey with a YouTube video can probably figure this out. It's pretty simple.
Yeah. Shout out to LEDs. we have like a kind of in this older looking chandelier, not a chandelier. It's not a chandelier, but like a light fixture above our kitchen table. That's one of the ones with like the old candle style lens or lamps. And I didn't buy like the little chandelier. I didn't buy the little flamey ones, but I bought just straight up LEDs. And like as I'm installing them, you're just putting in LED light bulbs. I'm like, these things are so hot, the old ones. It's like the amount of heat that they generate, it's just so indicative of how, you know, what kind of energy is going into them. You're just like, wow. What a great thing that this has been for us to have in this world, right?
We bought like a couple of years ago, we bought a new thing for one of our powder rooms, like an overhead light. And we put these beautiful like just before Canada banned all these incandescents, we put these like beautiful round bulbs in them. And like you walk in there with the door closed, you're like, it's hot in here. From the lights, like how much is this costing me to run all these LEDs or all these incandescents? So we've in Canada, it's very hard to buy a incandescent light anymore unless you have like a very special use case, which is becoming less and less. Like if you have like
an easy bake oven,
literally that's what I had to buy. My daughter's easy bake oven broke and I cracked it open and it's just a 100-watt light bulb.
And yeah, like it is. You can't. I had a creepy crawlers. I know all about that.
Creepy colors is the best.
Yeah.
But luckily you can still buy 100-watt light bulbs because they're considered like work lights, which makes no sense because you can get 1,000 times brighter LED light for working than a light bulb. But I think a lot of people have these old, it's like super thick. But luckily I could find a 100-watt light bulb and we're cooking again.
Hey, I got quick before we wrap up here. I saw that you were talking about on your new office, it'd be really nice to have like an outdoor light that said that you were recording out of your office. So I have kind of this set up, but I can't get it into a way that is that interesting or nice. I want to hear maybe what you or the audience has to think about this. I have a Hue, Philips Hue light bulb that is red on the outside of my door, and it is in like a little light fixture, and it works as red, but I have not found a good ergonomic way to have it turn on while I'm recording. Like I have this, you know what actually be really great is I have the Stream Deck, which is just that little macro pad. I would love just to work on there, but you can't like connect any of that stuff to any of that stuff. That's the worst part about home automation stuff is that there's always like a gap there where I'm like, I just want to connect this. So if anyone out there has a good idea on how to connect a Philips Hue bulb to a hardware button, let me know.
You got to be able to like code up a little serverless function that hits the Philips Hue API. And like, can you not make buttons on the Stream Deck to do whatever you want?
Yeah, I don't know.
You know what? So here's my idea.
Mic cutting out like this? It's so weird.
Yeah, that's okay. I think it sounds okay. Okay. I think instead of explicitly turning it on and off, you should figure out, like what I do is when I hit record, I hit F19 and it also turns my computer into do not disturb mode. You could write something on your computer that constantly checks if you are in do not disturb mode. Mm. And if you are in do not disturb mode, then ping Philips Hue to turn on that light. Because then you don't even have to think about it.
Clever, clever man.
Passive, yeah. Like you don't even have to, I forgot to turn it on, you know? Like as long as it knows that you're recording. Or like, could you figure out what recording your software if it is currently in record mode?
I don't know.
I think do not disturb is better because then you could also just flip that on anytime you want. I want to do it.
Yep. Now I want to do it.
Yeah. I want to get like an on air sign and yeah, have it.
Yeah.
Figure
on
out
air.
Somehow.
Yeah. Something like run Uncle Jesse. For that.
That's a good, my new office. I'm trying to think about what wiring I want to run everywhere. So I didn't even think of that. Now that you said I'm in.
Make sure you get that Ethernet.
Yeah. I'm going to run. Like, what else would you run? Like, I'm going to run 2 Cat 6 Ethernets to my desk. Mm-hmm. You think that's enough? And then I'm going to run an empty tube into the utility room so that I can fish. I'm like, but you wouldn't need to run fiber to your desk ever, would you?
No. Yeah, we have fiber connected in the house and then Ethernet. Yeah.
Trying to think about like what else would you run?
If it was me and I was doing it from scratch, I would like get XLR and then have my monitors attached through this and have all the XLR. Like my buddy, we were talking about flying my monitors and he was like, yeah, you really want to do is get the XLR through the walls. And I was like, I'm not going to do that.
But then how would you pipe that into your computer though? Because you got to come back. For your computer.
Well, you would just, the way professional studios have it is they just have an outlet, like an XLR outlet on the wall.
Oh.
So you would have, like, let's say they were being flown from the ceiling. You would have XLR plugs into the ceiling and then that's into the walls and then an XLR outlet.
So you could hang a microphone from the ceiling.
You could do any of that. Yeah. He specializes in like recording studio design. So it's a little bit different of an application, but still,
that's not a bad idea. I thought like the longest time I'm like, I would love to put my entire rack in a separate room.
Yeah,
but
he does that.
Freaking Thunderbolt, like Linus Tech Tips did this. He put a server in a server room and he ran one Thunderbolt cable to his monitor. But then his wife was complaining. I always have to go and reboot it and it doesn't work as good as you think it's going to work, you know? And I'm like, I don't know if we're there yet. And like a Thunderbolt cable that's, I don't know, like a 100 feet is like $1,000 or something like that. So I don't know if we're there yet.
Yep. I hear you.
cool. Well, we should have a talk and shop offices episode at some point. I love talking about this stuff.
Me too. I'm all about it.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. And oh no, we got to shamelessly plug westboss.com/courses. Buy a course, get a free one, you name it, support me or Scott. And obviously those are just mine. Scott, how will we support you?
Yeah, don't support me or Scott. Support me and Scott. just joking. Leveluptutorials.com is where you can catch all my stuff. We have a new course every single month. The course that we just released is on exploring browser APIs. The course before that was on Supabase and Remix, where John Myers built a real-time chat app, and it's incredible. And then even before that, we had a course with me doing Svelte 3D. So if you like all of this and more, check it out, leveluptutorials.com, and you can get in. We're doing a huge redesign right now. So if you get in before the redesign, you can keep that price for after the redesign. So yeah, get in now. Well, you still Beautiful. Can. Yeah.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Catch you on Friday.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.